Hello, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Rachel Cobb. I'm the station manager for KGLP. To my left is Elizabeth Harden Varola, a local reporter who covers religion for the Gallup Independent and also writes for the National Catholic Reporter. Terry McKiernan is from Boston and a founder of bishopaccountability.com and was a consultant for the Spotlight film. Robert E. Pastor is a Phoenix attorney who represented 18 sex abuse claimants in the Diocese of Gallup's bankruptcy case. We have Ralph Lind, a professional clinical counselor and pastor from Albuquerque, who has experience treating adults who were sexually abused as children, and Bill Keeler, a Gallup attorney who currently represents 4 Native plaintiffs in sex abuse lawsuits against the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, the Mormon Church. So with that, I'm going to come back to Elizabeth.
I am Elizabeth Harden Varola. I've been a freelance correspondent with the Gallup Independent for 16 years, and in recent years, I've also worked for the National Catholic Reporter covering the Diocese of Gallup bankruptcy. And the idea behind this event was that Spotlight came out last November, and that was when the Diocese of Gallup began its third year. It started its third year in bankruptcy court. And when I saw Spotlight, it basically told the story of what happened in the Diocese of Gallup. Even though Spotlight is set in Boston and it's an urban setting, what you see in the movie happened here in the Diocese of Gallup, just on a smaller scale and also in a more rural scale. And so I kept waiting for the movie to come here, and it never did. And so I thought it would be a good opportunity to let local audiences see the movie on the big screen. And I also thought it would be a good opportunity for us as a community to talk about protecting children, how we can protect children better. Because every single week in our paper, we have stories about children being sexually abused here in Gallup, across Native communities, reservations. And I just thought we could do a conversation about how we could do a better job on that. I also thought we could do a better job in terms of maybe learning how to support adult survivors of sex abuse, because again, we have so many people in this area that are affected by childhood trauma. And so that was sort of the idea. And I do want to note that we did invite Bishop Wall to participate. The Diocese of Gallup is wrapping up its bankruptcy this summer. It's not completely out of bankruptcy court yet, and I thought it would be a good opportunity for the bishop to come and talk a little bit about what's happened here in the Diocese of Gallup, which stretches across western New Mexico and all across northeastern Arizona. And I thought it'd be a good opportunity for him to explain the church's efforts to protect children now and also their efforts to support survivors. But he declined to participate and declined to send a representative. But we are in his place. We were able to get Ralph Lind, who graciously accepted at the last minute, and he is a former minister, and he has that experience of working with people who were sexually abused as children. With the Spotlight film, I think it's definitely impacted our area, because as I was talking to people earlier, I don't think I would have written one story about sexual abuse in the Diocese of Gallup had not the reporters of the Boston Globe did what they did in this story. I don't think Bill Keeler would have had one person come forward with an allegation. I don't think Robert Pastor would have had anyone come forward. I don't think the Diocese of Gallup would be in bankruptcy. So what happens in the movie Spotlight has definitely impacted this community greatly, and it's impacted all of our lives. In the book of John, in the New Testament, Jesus said, "You shall know the truth, and the truth will set you free." I've thought about that a lot all these years of covering sex abuse, and not only in the church. That is one other point I'd like to make, is that all these years of covering the Diocese of Gallup, it has caused other people to come forward to me. It's a reflection of the Gallup community. Native American people, Hispanic people, Anglo people have all come and confided stories about how they also were sexually abused as children. Not necessarily by anyone from church, but teachers, principals, family members, relatives, friends of family. So there's far more people out there than any of us realize. And so I've thought through the years of that saying of what Jesus said, if you shall know the truth, and the truth will set you free. And so as a journalist, I guess my perspective has been, we as a community need to speak the truth about sexual abuse in order to protect children. We need to speak the truth in order to hold sex offenders accountable for their crimes. We need to speak the truth to validate the experiences of sex abuse survivors who are all around us, but we don't know it because they're silent. And we need to speak the truth to help the children of adult survivors who are also out there who had a very different childhood because of what happened to their parents. So anyway, with that, I will pass, but thank you.
So my name is Terry McKiernan, and I run an organization called bishopaccountability.org. And I'm really here in Gallup because of Elizabeth. I've been following her journalism for many years with great admiration. And I'm very, very excited now to be here in the place that she has covered so beautifully over the years. And I've been meeting some survivors here. And I think it's important to say that all of us up here are here because of survivors, and because survivors have had the incredible courage to come forward and tell their stories and to begin to uncover what's a terrible problem. And I think it is important to reiterate what Elizabeth said, that, of course, my specialty, if you will, is clergy abuse in the Catholic Church. But child abuse of all kinds is endemic in our society in so many institutions. And it is certainly not out of any animus for the Catholic Church that I do what I do. In fact, I still go to Mass. I was actually up at the cathedral earlier today. So one sentence about my organization. You might have noticed on the table out front, there's a list of all the priests and others in the Catholic Church we know of accused in the Diocese of Gallup. One thing that we do as an organization is to keep track of that kind of information in a database. And I think it's a very, very useful tool for survivors, people like Elizabeth, people like Bob Pastor to my left. In order to understand this, we need to know who is doing it, where they've been. And my organization tries to gather that kind of information. We also gather investigative reporting on it, and we also gather documents in their hundreds and thousands and tens of thousands on the website. So it's a good place to go to learn about this. It's kind of a tough place to go. It's not a happy story, I know, but I think it's a story that needs to be told. My little connection with Spotlight was that Mike Resendiz, one of the reporters in the movie, is a buddy of mine. And he recommended to the people in the movie that they come to me to write the lists at the end of the movie. And as you have noticed or will notice, Gallup is on that list, unfortunately.
Thank you. My name is Bob Pastor. I'm a lawyer in Phoenix. To sort of dispel any notion that this is a Catholic bashing fest. I am Catholic. I'm raising my three sons Catholic. I had Catholic education from first grade to the time I graduated from Boston College in 1997. So it's been a part of my life. It is a part of my life. I'm practicing law for 15 years, and the first survivor of abuse who was harmed by a priest of this diocese came into my office in either late 2007, early 2008. I thought, as a good Catholic, the church would listen to me, that I could serve my client well. and that we could bring some closure to this individual's, you know, awful experience and the life he had lived. And I quickly learned that that wasn't the case. That was in 07, 08, and here I am in 2016, and the Diocese of Gallup cases are barely closing. So, you know, I'm here because of survivors, because of their courage, because they had the strength to get up and tell their story. But I'm also here because, you know, as a Catholic, I want the church to be better. I don't have much need anymore for the institutional church, for the guy who wears the Roman collar. I believe in this guy, Jesus, who walked the earth and did great things. And it's my belief that we are the church. We are the ones who should make this world better. And I guess my piece is to try to shine a light on a problem that no one wants to talk about, certainly bishops and priests. So thank you all for coming here. If you are a survivor, if you are a parent of a survivor, aunt, uncle, spouse of a survivor, know that you're not alone, that there are people out there who support you, even though you may not know their name or see their face. And also know that we believe you, and this is not your fault. So thank you for coming, and I sincerely hope all of you will participate in the discussion and ask your questions or share your story if you feel comfortable doing so. Thank you. Oh, and real quick, investigative journalism is tremendously important. Elizabeth came to my office in Phoenix, and I thought this was one little case that I would do a good job on, and I would move on to the next case. And Elizabeth came to me and, you know, sat in my conference room and kind of told me, "Do you know what you have?" I thought, "No, I don't, but tell me." And from that one meeting, you know, sparked a lot of thought and discussion, and my eyes were opened, and Elizabeth and the Gallup Independent have been a tremendous resource in terms of the information that Elizabeth has collected, and that, frankly, that Bishop Accountability has made available. So thank you all for being here.
My name, excuse me, my name is Ralph Lind. I'm very grateful to be here this evening, both as part of the panel. Thank you all for coming, and hope that it is meaningful and useful to you. I'd like to briefly introduce myself and why I'm here. My experience is different in coming to this particular focus. The origins of my interest come in the treatment aspect. I'm a therapist. Prior to being a therapist, I was a pastor in the Mennonite Church for about 15 years, and the last 15 years as a therapist in Albuquerque. Much of that time, my focus has been on marriage counseling, relationship, couple therapy. This isn't going to surprise anyone that couples who are in trouble and who come for help generally will have that problem or those problems manifest in sexual intimacy issues. What I was unprepared for was that the frequency of those problems originating long before their relationship began, long before they were aware of where those origins might have been. Range of severity is quite large, ranging from simple disinterest in sexual intimacy or the inability to be sexual, or compulsive and addictive sexual acting out behaviors, and also compulsive and addictive pornography use. Any and all of these activities are disruptive, but I was not prepared to understand, much less treat, these kinds of issues and problems in relationships. That led me to seek more education and training. Long story short, 3 years later, I was certified to become a sex addiction therapist. One of the most frequent and significant origins of these compulsive or addictive sexual behaviors is associated with trauma. There are certainly other places that lead to the kind of issues and concerns, but trauma is very strongly associated, and especially childhood sex abuse trauma. In my practice, the Catholic Church and the priest sex abuse issues are quite a minority. Every religious group or faith or denomination has experiences of sex abuse by those who are in power and privilege. There are no exceptions, my faith included, in the Mennonite Church. All sex abuse can have severe and lifelong altering consequences. In a religious or spiritual context, the damage deepens. Trust issues go deep and include what was thought to be safe. That undermines a great deal of continuing development and affects in rippling concentric circles, family, and trust in God as well as other people. Sexual intimacy is one of the deepest expressions of being human, providing intimacy with other humans. It's a beautiful gift. It's to be treasured. But consequently, sexual wounds, especially in formative childhood, are the deepest and most severe and long-lasting. The good news is that this trauma and these problems are treatable. I hope that my participation can spread that truth and reality this evening. I think that's enough.
Good evening. My name is Bill Keeler, and I'm an attorney here in Gallup, New Mexico. I was asked to come here today to kind of give a different perspective of what victims sometimes have to deal with when we have to file cases out on the Navajo Nation court system. As it was said earlier, we have represented victims against the Catholic Church out on the Navajo Nation, and now we're currently representing victims against the LDS Church, the Mormons. We are currently in federal court up in Salt Lake City and awaiting decision by the judge to kind of outline what we're going to hopefully be able to do out in the Navajo Nation court system. I'm going to keep this short because I know everybody's anxious to go ahead and get started.
And how we want to start, I believe, is to open this up to anyone in our audience who would like to make comments, who would like to ask a question of the panel, or if the panel wishes to interject based on that feedback, then that's more than welcome as well.
I was wondering, I'm not sure who this question should be addressed to, but I know that abusers have often been abused, and I'm wondering, especially with the priests and church authorities, church leaders, if that has been addressed.
I'd be happy to make a quick comment on that. I'm sure plenty of us would like to say something about that. In Catholicism anyway, I think the hierarchy, the management, is very aware that that's the case, but they are quite reluctant to seize the nettle and do something about it. I think that sexual harassment and sexual abuse, even up to rape, is very, very common in Catholic seminaries. There's been some attempt to make the seminaries more aware of this problem, to actually educate their priests in issues of sexuality. There's a wonderful man named Richard Seip who has written about this extensively over the years. But I do not see a truly significant change in what's happening in the seminaries. And compounding that problem is that as priests get grayer and grayer in the United States and begin to die off, we're getting more and more priests from other countries where there hasn't even been the slightest attempt to reform the seminaries. So that would be my view.
Yeah, and just following up on that comment, I mean, I've heard that comment as really as a defense or explanation for why clergy sexual abuse occurs. And, you know, I just want to add that I don't think we should try to limit the causes to, oh, well, that priest was abused in seminary, and therefore he's acting out. I've talked to therapists and clinicians and forensic psychologists who have said, you know, it's learned behavior, and sometimes they act out on the acts that are performed on them. But, you know, the causes of clergy sexual abuse are many. I think there is a historical problem in the seminary and a current problem in the seminary with that sort of behavior and conduct, but it's not, I don't want anyone to walk away saying, hey, that's the cause of it. The cause is much deeper. And I think as Catholics requires us to ask much deeper questions about the priesthood.
I was born in the 50s, and I can see over my lifetime that sex itself has greatly become more and more a part of our society, ongoing. And kids at younger ages now participate no more. I'm wondering, at least from what I can see, all right, and what you could suggest. It doesn't seem that there's enough of a response from religious people in general to unify themselves and to close down, for example, pornographic stores that, you know, that I've been in them before to see what they are, or pornographic movie theaters, or all kinds of restaurants and, just all kinds of, just even brothels. Okay. I don't see really, and I wonder why there isn't more of a unity to go and do something about these places which help to, continue the problems that we have with sex.
Well, maybe we should talk about sex more often. I mean, as Catholics, we don't talk about sex, and there's nothing wrong with it. As the therapist said, it's a beautiful thing. Don't necessarily disagree with pornography and the other things, but God made us to have sex. Nothing wrong with it.
I think there's many answers. One of the responses that I would like to make is that the industries that you're naming, pornography, as well as industries that wouldn't quite fit in that description, are incredibly powerful. The amount of money is beyond imagination. The amount of power that's associated with that is unbelievable. The amount of use that the internet has for pornography is unbelievable. The proportions are very, very high. And we talk about it being AAA, anonymous, affordable, accessible. Thank you. So those are very powerful aspects. You're not going to find children who do not have access to the internet. So it's not a matter of if, it's a matter of when, and preparing them for what they will see and how they see sexual intimacy portrayed is critical. I will stop there. I could go a while.
I think I'd have to go with both of them and say you have to be able to talk openly with your kids. I have an 11-year-old daughter, and I'd much rather her be able to come to me and be open and talk about what she's seen or what she has heard. And unfortunately, kids all have these phones and they can get on the internet anytime they want. And I just think it's important that people are open to questions and giving out answers.
And if I could bring it back to the immediate topic, unfortunately, we find in working on these clergy abuse cases that clergy are often practitioners of the very arts that our questioner was talking about. Priests are producing pornography, using pornography, encouraging their victims to use pornography, when tragically, really it ought to be that the churches are moral forces in the community. And I think that what has happened over the course of this crisis in Catholicism and elsewhere is that the churches have disabled their own response to the problems that you're describing.
The Diocese of Gallup was invited. They were not able to send a representative. They have not provided a statement. John Wester, the Archbishop in the Archdiocese of Santa Fe, has had a history of doing some good and of shuffling priests around. There are well-meaning people in the church, and there are also some perpetrators. So my question for you is there a likelihood that in the next 5 to 10 years we may see a turnaround in the way that the church handles discrepancies within its ranks?
Well, certainly the Diocese of Gallup faces that challenge now because of bankruptcy court. As part of bankruptcy court, they negotiated a list of non-monetary commitments, and they did that with a committee of abuse survivors that were claimants in the bankruptcy court case, and some of the members of that committee are here tonight. But the diocese committed to changing their behavior, and actually they're supposed to be starting those changes very soon. The effective date, I believe, was August 11th, and some of those kick in within 30 days of August 11th, 60 days of August 11th, a year of August 11th. So the bishop has a number of things on his agenda that if he follows them, it will be changing the way they are supposed to handle this. But that remains to be seen. We'll have to see how they choose to do that.
So I don't necessarily disagree with Elizabeth, but sort of answer the question in two ways, the macro, the immediate, and the micro. You know, we heard there's a line in the movie where someone says, I think to Walter Robertson, that says, you know, the church doesn't think in years, it thinks in centuries. And so the question is, do you think the church is going to change as a result of this crisis and the things that have been exposed? And I would say, and I think your qualification was in the next 5 years, right? And I think my answer is no, because the church thinks in centuries, not years. And the current, you know, slate of bishops across the world and archbishops across the world were appointed largely by John Paul II and Benedict. John Paul II and Benedict are two extremely conservative popes. They appointed bishops in their mindset and of their like. And I attended a lecture by a Jesuit named Reese. He used to work with America. He gave a lecture at my high school, Brophy Prep in Phoenix. So I attended, and I posed the same question. I said, when are we going to see the effects of Pope Francis's changes? You know, when are we going to see bishops appointed in the likeness of Pope Francis? And, you know, his answer was, you know, you're probably not going to see it in your lifetime, or at least his lifetime, maybe my lifetime because I'm younger. But, you know, Pope Francis hasn't appointed that many bishops yet. Bishop Wall was appointed under
Benedict.
Benedict is Cardinal Ratzinger. Cardinal Ratzinger was in charge of the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith. That was the office in Rome that received all of the reports of abuse from around the world. And Ratzinger is the same man who sent a letter to Ireland encouraging people not to report to civil authorities. So, short, back to the answer, no, we're not going to see a change in 5 years. maybe in 100 years. Let's hope.
You know, I'd add to that that I agree with Bob, honestly. I think the culture is very durable, very resistant to change. A footnote about your question, the Archbishop in Santa Fe isn't this Archbishop's superior. It's a very, very flat reporting structure, and they all report to the Pope, and they go every 5 years. They will go as a group and talk with the Pope about how it's going or how it's not going. Let me give a little example that I think perhaps provides a little bit of hope, but also throws a little cold water on this quickly. The Gallup Diocese posted a list of accused, which is a good step. But there's a person in this room who is abused by someone who's not on that list, should be on that list and is not on that list, and she is not the only victim of that priest, of that cleric. My feeling is that these lists are issued reluctantly, but they provide us with a little bit of leverage. We can go to them and say, why isn't this guy on it? Why haven't you given us the entire assignment history of the people who are on it? And they are nudged gradually into the real world that the rest of us live in. I think there's some hope of that, but a sea change, I don't see it happening soon.
Thank you all for being here, and whoever is promoting this, I really appreciate it. Thank you. Having grown up Catholic myself and having a brother who is a priest, I have wrestled a lot with these questions and issues. And I'm wondering if the church, I'm wondering if there has been any studies, have there been any studies done on the amount of sexual abuse in other religions or faiths where there is not celibacy, and if there's any connection between celibacy and clerical priests actually abusing children.
I'm unaware of any study of that nature.
Yeah, there are a number of studies of sexual abuse in the public school system, but it's very, very hard to draw a bead on comparatively on the situation in Catholicism and compare it with other denominations. We know more about abuse in the Boy Scouts, which is extensive and troubling. Bless you. But we're not able to make that comparison. I'm wondering if it would be okay in the format here to throw it back to you. I'm curious, as the sister of a priest, how do you answer that question? You know, is celibacy at issue here?
Well, celibacy is not the issue. I agree. But it just... I guess I go back to the speaker that had the question over there about the pervasiveness of lack of boundaries in our society. My concern is that as our society becomes more and more used to a certain code of behavior and certain ethical behaviors, that the window keeps opening more and more, and then more and more continues. I mean, I have been exposed to pornography. I know how devastating it can be. And I know that a lot of the people who become the pawns or the victims are not the people that control the industries or that receive money and benefit from those industries. I guess the question about celibacy came about because I just wondered if, I mean, they are two separate issues, but I just wondered if the fact that there is, one person up there said, I don't remember if it was you, Mr. Pastor, or someone else, that we have to talk about sex, we have to deal with it. And I grew up in a repressive Catholic household where sex was not talked about. And, you know, and it was like, it didn't seem right. And maybe that's, I mean, it didn't seem normal to talk about it. It seemed wrong. And I wonder how many other children growing up in Catholic backgrounds have that in their family systems, and if that contributes then to young men and young women that think they want to become a priest or a nun because of that repression, and then that's also repressing their sexuality. And if the dialogue was more open in the church as well as in families, and not just about sexuality, but also about opening the doors to allowing women to become priests and allowing men to be married and having that kind of, quote, I don't want to say normal because that's defining it too, but having relationships within family systems where sexuality is considered a sacred thing rather than a horrible thing.
I'd like to comment briefly on that. I don't know of any studies either. I think it'd be extremely difficult. But just from anecdotal experience point of view, I do think that priesthood, being celibate as a priest, draws some young men who may be deeply struggling with sexual issues, and they look to that as a way that they will be helped. They'll somehow, by God's power or training or whatever it is, they'll be able to be relieved of some of the sexual problems that they experience. It's kind of parallel to sometimes people who have sexual intimacy issues and think that marriage is going to solve it. And it doesn't. So I'd be hard-pressed to offer proof, but those are some of the thoughts that often go along with this particular discussion.
The woman who asked the question used an interesting choice of words, boundary issues, right? And I think all of us have questions about why is this occurring? Why does this happen? And, you know, the church in the litigation and then in public relation type events, they've used the term that these are crimes of the past. And in the litigation, we stopped hearing that because some reports and claims came out that, hey, some events transpired in 2014 and 2000, you know, in modern times. So they couldn't say it was a crime of the past. But you know, if you're one of these men or women, maybe, that Ralph is talking about in terms of that has deeply deep issues, deep sexual issues that you're struggling through, and you want instant credibility and you want cover, meaning protection, the priesthood is a good place to go. And so that's why, you know, the things that I tell the priests if I ever get to talk to them, or bishops if I ever get to talk to them, is look, don't think this is a crime of the past, because, you know, if you're a pedophile and are attracted to children, well, your goal is to get more children. So go become a priest, because everyone trusts a priest. And we all know historically the church will protect you. But, you know, kind of touching on the issues of boundary issues, and the reason why I pick up on those words is because, and I'm going to try to repeat what I've learned from reading some of Richard Sipe's books and from speaking with Richard Sipe in person. But if you're a man, and let's say you have some questions about sexuality, or you're really underdeveloped sexually, psychosexually, you know, you go become a priest, and the first thing they tell you in priesthood is, hey, we're not going to talk about sex. And the second thing they tell you in priesthood is, you're not going to have sex. And so you go through priesthood, and you pray, and you read the Bible, and you study, and don't, so on and so forth, and then they ordain you, and they put you out in a parish, and you've had no sexual development, psychosexual development. And so what some of Sipe's theories are that you have the psychosexual development and capacity of a 14-year-old, and you don't know boundaries. And so you think it's okay to make a comment about a 14-year-old's butt or breasts or what have you, and all of a sudden you got a problem, a big one. So, you know, I do believe we got to talk about sex. When Sister Josephine gave me the lecture on sex in fifth grade, it wasn't good enough, and we need to talk about it more. And, you know, I think celibacy is at issue.
Democratic vice presidential candidate Tim Kaine has been quoted as saying something to the effect that, as a devout Catholic, he believes that the time will come, I don't know, maybe 200 years, when same-sex marriage would be an option for anyone, but I don't know about priests. Again, it is about a long-term cultural shift in values. And with each generation, there should be an opportunity for that change, shouldn't there? A change in better accepting, dropping the celibacy requirements, better accepting the possibility of marriage for priests, as it goes along with the overall view of sexuality.
I'm not sure what there's a priest that's married in Phoenix at St. Maria Goretti, so you can be a Catholic priest and be married.
If you were a Lutheran beforehand.
Okay. So if you want to be a priest, go be Lutheran and then come in.
Yeah.
So far we've centered on the Catholic Church. And going back to some earlier comments and the way things have changed today, when I was a kid, and maybe some of you, if you're my age or older, three things you didn't talk about at the dinner table, at least, or in polite society, were sex, religion, and politics, which just about the only thing that was okay was talking about the weather. And that has changed in our lifetime. We've seen these problems with the Catholic Church in national newspapers and local newspapers in the last couple of decades. We've also seen similar problems at universities, Penn State I'm thinking of, and here in Gallup at Gallup High School. Similar situations where an adult had control over younger people and could get them to do what they wanted them to do. Are there any thoughts from the panel regarding other institutions other than the Catholic Church?
I'm currently working on cases against the Mormon Church LDS, and what we're focusing on is they had a program called the Indian Placement Program where they would come out to the Navajo Reservation and we suspect other reservations and recruit children into the program, baptize them on the reservation, and send them back to families in Utah where they were abused. So that's one of the instances that we're currently working on right now. And if you have anything specific about it, I'll be more than happy to answer it for you.
I don't know if this was covered because I apologize for coming in late, but wasn't the original reason for celibacy in the Catholic Church to preserve the church's huge lands holdings, in other words, the patrimony of the Catholic Church through the ages? And if that's so, do you see any possibility for the church loosening up the idea that priests could marry eventually? You know, more priests, not just the individual ones here and there.
Okay, well, I'll take a stab at it. I am hardly any expert on the history of the Catholic Church. I've probably read the same things you've read. I believe priests were married. Someone can correct me, I think, for probably the first 1,000 years of the Catholic Church. And yes, I have also read those were the reasons to protect property so that it wouldn't go on to their wives or children or grandchildren. And so they would consolidate. You know, in terms of what you just said in previous question about speculating whether the Catholic Church will ever allow marriage, I mean, it's just a guess on my part. I've always felt eventually it will happen, but I think to me the stickler is if they open marriage to heterosexual couples and allow priests to get married to a woman, then they're going to have a big quandary on their hands for the number of gay priests that will then want to marry their partners. And so by continuing to block it off entirely, they're sidestepping that problem. That's just my guess.
You know, back to one of the other comments about other institutions of trust, you know, going to, you know, kind of my desire or reason for being here to try to believe that we can make the church better or any institution of trust better. You know, you have children, like let's take the Penn State situation, for example. You know, these kids watch these superstars on TV and they come from the projects or some poor neighborhood in Pennsylvania and all of a sudden they get to go walk inside the locker room where these heroes go out on the battlefield and you know, go on to victory. I mean, imagine what an awesome experience that would be. I mean, as a kid, I would be like, oh my gosh, that's awesome. You know, Joe Paterno. Well, that same sort of awe that a child may have going into the Penn State locker room is the same sort of awe that I've heard from clients when they were taken back in the sacristy, when they were allowed to touch the chalice, when they were allowed to see where the priest slept. And so, you know, as parents, that's sort of some of the things you got to be on the lookout for. If your kid is getting too close to someone who is in that role, you need to put the brakes on and say, hey, no. You know, I've done cases against teachers and school districts who have molested kids. And, you know, a teacher should not have a Facebook relationship with a child and shouldn't be texting them and messaging them and then, you know, having secret internet rendezvous things. Those are all breaking the boundary issues that we all have to be mindful of when we talk to our children and grandchildren and nieces and nephews and so on. So the issues in the Catholic Church in terms of the grooming and the breaches of trust apply to Boy Scouts, Penn State, Mormon Church, school districts, youth sports organizations, after-school care programs, all of those things.
And also mothers and fathers. It's worth saying that bad as horrible as clergy abuse is, most of the abuse that occurs in the United States is incestuous abuse of one sort or another. I'd mentioned related comment to what Bob just said, and Ralph knows much more about this than I do, but a fascinating, very, very terrible case in the Mennonite Church involves a man named John Howard Yoder, who was a very famous Mennonite theologian, a very, very eminent, powerful man in the Mennonite Church. So powerful, in fact, that he was able to sexually harass, molest, assault, and rape over 100 women. And the Mennonite hierarchy, such as it is, was really very, very incapable of dealing with this because there was that awe operating with this man. He had arrogated to himself some of the kind of glow that that priests have in the Catholic tradition, I think.
I have a comment and a question. The comment is, well, it's unfortunate that Bishop Wall's not here. I think that in addition to the looking at what you can do to prevent abuse with the hierarchy and amidst the priests is working with the children to prepare them to avoid the abuse. And the Catholic Church nationally has come up with a curriculum that we use in our Protestant church that's really wonderful. It's called the Circle of Grace, and it helps teach children from kindergarten through high school about boundaries, and I think that's very helpful. My question is related to one of the things I noticed in the Spotlight movie was that really struck me was the power and the power of the Catholic Church financially and politically and maybe socially to cover this up for so long. And I'm a retired ER physician, and the worst part of my job was doing sexual assault exams, especially on children. And the case that I remember most vividly was the one that I thought was most easily prosecuted, except that the alleged perpetrator had a very good attorney. And my question are there resources to help the prosecution do a better job, maybe even just like preparing me for my testimony, financial or other kinds of resources for that?
In terms of doing a criminal case, I think it's unfortunate that what it seems like you were saying is that it was a good case, but the prosecution didn't do a good job prosecuting the case. Is that correct?
Or the defense just did a better job.
Well, I mean, what it comes down to is unfortunately, the prosecution has so many cases and only so many resources. So it can sometimes be a problem that will get swept aside. They may be working on something else. I can't explain really what happened to it without knowing more details, but it just sometimes happens, unfortunately.
You know, I'm a former prosecutor from Maricopa County, which is the largest county in Arizona. And according to, like, the national prosecuting advisory agencies, sex crimes prosecutors are supposed to have it's a guidepost, not a rule, a certain number of sex crime cases and no more. And I know in Maricopa County, you know, it's over, way over the number. And so the comment is correct. Prosecutors have more cases than anyone would like them to have or that they can actually manage. But, you know, one of the things that, you know, I do, I represent victims of crime because survivors of abuse are often victims of crime. And being a former prosecutor, I have a case right now. A physical therapist sexually assaulted my client. Prosecutor looks at me as some money-hungry plaintiff's lawyer that, you know, is going to screw up her case. And I try to go in and say, hey, look, I'm here to help you. I'm going to make sure that the victim is prepared to tell her story. I'm going to make sure that you get the medical records that you need that corroborates the allegation and the facts of abuse. And I try to educate them on prosecutors, that is, on the fact that, you know, the scars created by sexual abuse are lifelong. We don't have an X-ray or an MRI study or some, you know, piece of, you know, medical evidence that we can show up. And so I try to say, I'm going to prepare your witness, because most of the times, you know, prosecutors prepare for their trial the week before, the day before, you know, 3 days before, the weekend of. And I know that because I was in those shoes, and that's what I did. You know, I had too many cases, and I didn't prep the witness often. Sometimes I didn't have time. So as an advocate for victims, I mean, I just tell them, hey, look, tell me when your trial date is, and I'm going to sit down with that client, and I'm going to make sure they know how to testify and that they're prepared. So, you know, as a physician, as someone who, if you're a social worker here, if you're, you know, there are lawyers who do victim advocacy, and if that case doesn't turn into a case that I can go and prosecute a civil claim, I do it for free because I want that SOB to be prosecuted, and that's what he deserves to do, right? So that's one resource. There's a whole community of lawyers that do that. It's part of the National Crime Victims Bar Association. I'm a member, and they're all over the country.
I have two questions. The first one is for Mr. Attorney on the end. You commented earlier that about your investigation or your ongoing litigation on the Navajo Nation, and it seems to parallel a little bit what you saw or what we saw in Spotlight from the standpoint that those journalists were looking to go after something larger than just the local priest who was abusing. I don't know to what extent you can comment, but I would like to hear from you. Are you seeing something similar with the LDS Church and the Navajo Nation?
To answer your question, simply yes. When our first two victims came into the office, it was a brother and sister, and we heard their story. We listened to what had happened, and we decided to go ahead and pursue it. And it was almost like the gates opened up because there were other victims out there, but Mr. Pastor can kind of comment on this. The same thing we always hear is, I didn't think anybody else was in that position, or I didn't think anybody would believe me, so I didn't want to come forward. So the more that this story has gotten out with the Indian Placement Program, the more calls we have received. Some people are not willing to do anything. They're still members of the church. They don't think that they can go forward with something, but it's for lack of a better phrase, kind of the tip of the iceberg is what I think we're looking at. Did that answer your question?
Yeah.
Okay.
my second question is for Elizabeth. I thought the largest story in Spotlight was the challenges that the Spotlight reporters had on their investigation and finding out. It wasn't just the story about the Catholic Church and what was going on. And so my question to you is, in light of how long you've been involved in kind of following this story, can you share with us, if you're willing, what your challenges have been in uncovering what has gone on here? And, you know, if you can share some of your biggest challenges.
Wow, I don't know. That's hard. I've been dealing with this for 14 years. And, I mean, this fell in my lap. It was nothing I ever sought. Oh, the challenges. Talking to abuse survivors, talking to the parents, it's just, they're such tragic stories. And I haven't, in my stories, I haven't told but a fraction of them, because many people have not wanted them in the paper. In the bankruptcy case, there was an attorney named James Sting. He was the legal counsel for the committee that represented the interests of abuse survivors. And at one court hearing, he said that this was an intergenerational tragedy. It not only affected the children who were just innocent little kids in Catholic schools, in Catholic parishes, but it affected their parents. I have two daughters, and I know even today, my girls are in their 20s. I still sometimes have a hard time letting go of slights. Someone said something to them that hurt their feelings or whatever, and I have a hard time letting that go all these years later. And I think of the parents I've talked to, they felt so helpless to protect their children. They thought they were doing good things by encouraging their children to be altar servers. They thought they were doing good things by encouraging their children to spend time with their parish priests. One mother in particular, she was a single mom. Her husband had died. And so she encouraged her son to spend so much time with a priest. And now she lives with so much guilt because of what happened to her son. And to listen to those stories, that is so difficult. There's another family I talked to, the husband and the wife, and same thing. They both had full-time jobs. They were raised to believe that the priests were right up there with Jesus Christ. And so they welcomed those priests in their home. I remember the mother saying, I always told my sons, go sit on his lap, go sit on his lap. And to hear the stories and the guilt that those parents live with for the rest of their lives, knowing that they didn't protect their children because they didn't know there was anything to protect them from. I think that's the biggest challenge. And that's what comes to mind.
If I could add, in Spotlight, you see 5, 6, 7 people dealing with that big story. Los Angeles Times, when they did their great work in 02 and 03, they had a team, really great team. Dallas Morning News, when they did their great work, late 90s into the 2000s, they had a team. You guys in Gallup, this is one person doing this phenomenal work. And from the outside, it looks to me like almost a miracle that someone alone can do what Elizabeth has done in Gallup. And since she's also put this whole thing together, maybe we could give her a little round of applause. What do you think?
Well, thank you. But you know what? There's so many stories I haven't covered. And I know for my critics, they probably think that's all I ever write about. And certainly, I hope that's not all I ever write about. I try to write feature stories about a lot of good things in Gallup. I've written a lot of good stories about the Catholic Church. I've written positive stories about parishes, priests, sisters. I've tried to present a balanced picture. On the other hand, there's a lot of stories I have not covered. And Terry actually mentioned the Boy Scouts. That is a regret I have. When news of what happened in the Boy Scouts was rolling across the country, my hands were full with something else. But I did look. There were clergy abusers on the Navajo Nation doing Boy Scout troops. And I kept thinking, I got to get to that story. I got to get to that story. I got to get to that story. And I never did. And that really weighs on me. Who were those scout leaders? What happened on the Navajo Nation in those Boy Scout troops? I've missed stories along the way, and I regret it. I would like to take the time right now. It's sort of not answering any particular question, but I would like to say that, the power of one person. There's a person in the audience tonight. I called her up a few days ago, and I'm going to get emotional. And I told her, you are absolutely my hero, because she did what all the rest of us need to do. A few years ago, she contacted me, and she told me about the abuse that she went through as a child. And it was not in the church. It was in her family. Very typical of the stories you see in the Gallup Independent every single week. She was sexually abused by a man who had married into her big, extended Navajo family, and she suffered tremendously in her life, like most abuse survivors suffer. And when she was a teenager, she went to the Gallup Indian Medical Center for a medical visit, and she told a nurse, and the nurse referred her to a counselor. And what did the counselor do? The counselor told her every reason in the world why she should be quiet and not tell anyone. He did not call the police. He silenced her. About a decade later, in her 20s, she told a counselor, a different counselor at the Gallup Indian Medical Center. That person picked up the phone, called the FBI in Gallup, gave the details, told the FBI how to contact her. Did the FBI contact her? No. A decade later, in 2009, she's married, has children, she's in her 30s. She needs to speak out. She's been trying to speak out. She contacts someone in law enforcement that she knows and tells them, and they contact the FBI. This time, the FBI did contact her. The FBI agent talked to her, seemed very skeptical about her story, but he did investigate. And when he investigated, he interviewed a number of women in her extended family and found several other victims from all generations. This man was in his 60s. He had been abusing multiple generations of girls and young women for generations. And she finally put a stop to it. They arrested him. Unfortunately, because of the statute of limitations, and the fact that, because of statute of limitations, they could, and a plea agreement, the plea agreement that his attorney worked out, they only brought one charge against him with the plea agreement. And so he served a very short time. He's already out, but at least she put a stop to intergenerational abuse that had been going on in this family for a long time, and she saved how many other young girls? And so I did invite her here, and I called her the other night, and I told her, you are my hero, because in the movie, and I wrote this down, in Spotlight, one of the attorneys says, if it takes a village to raise a child, it takes a village to abuse it. And then another quote, the reporter is telling an official from the Catholic Church, an attorney from the Catholic Church, a guy leans on a guy and the whole town looks away. For years, all of us, whether we're school teachers, parents, coaches, whatever, we hear stories and often we turn away. But this woman, she wouldn't turn away. She knew the truth She knew what was right. She kept trying to tell the truth until finally someone listened to her. And so I guess that's one of the purposes of this event. I'm just hoping that all of us can have these conversations with each other to try to bring this out in the open more and save all these younger kids that are in our community by speaking up and doing the right thing like she did.
Elizabeth referred to the two gentlemen meeting in the bar and the one gentleman portraying the church official kind of did the best not ask any more questions type thing. It would seem to me that possibly those entities that are very famous throughout the world, a couple of churches, the sports entity, Pennsylvania, the Boy Scouts, it would seem to me that their lives are on the line and they might be running and afraid of us, because one of the things that I believe this group has in common is the fact that we are not going to take this anymore and speaking out will help. But one of the other questions I would like to ask you, and I don't know who best to answer, this affects everybody worldwide, no matter, even if we never meet them. What is, besides the psychological, physical cost, what is the cost in the multi-millions of dollars that I'm sure it's costing people throughout the world? And I don't know if any of you would choose to answer that, but it's got to be trillions. It's affecting all of us.
We've been reminded with a completely different issue in New York recently that if you see something, report it. And just briefly, if it's on the reservation, it's in the schools, if it's in your church, if you see something, don't be afraid to question it and report it. And then again, the comment about in the movie about being leaned on. One of the problems we had, Elizabeth, here in Gallup, at Gallup High, was a person in power that was doing things wrong, had things on other people, and they were afraid that if they did something to that person, that there would be retaliation, some embarrassment might be brought to them, and so everything's just swept under the rug and not brought to the fore. That's all. Thank you.
You know, and that comment about sweeping things under the rug and retaliation, I mean, that's one of the themes in the movie. Why does this continue to exist? Why is clergy sexual abuse continue to occur? And you know, you hear Sipe on the phone talk about the statistical numbers that he believes, the number of priests who are engaging in sex or sexual misconduct, and they go out and try to look for 80 some odd or some odd number of priests by tracking them. But you know, the question was brought up earlier, is celibacy at issue? Well, if 50% of priests are engaging in some sort of conduct of a sexual nature, you know, what happens is, hey, I'm not going to tell on you if you don't tell on me. And oh, you're having sex with a woman? Well, I'm having sex with a 13-year-old. And it, that's how it happens. That's the culture of secrecy, I think, is tied to celibacy. And we do need to talk about it. In terms of the comment about how it's costing us and tying it to Elizabeth's comment about statute of limitations, you know, that's one of the hurdles we always face in civil suits. And I'm a lawyer, I'm an advocate, so I'm going to advocate a little bit here. You might think, oh, these lawsuits, they don't do our society well. They don't. They serve no purpose. It only serves lawyers. It doesn't. I can't speak to it, but there are survivors in the audience who can speak to it. But we are paying for it as a society. We pay for it in our prison system. We pay for it in our addiction counseling and recovery systems. We pay for it in our police departments, in the abuse and domestic violence and all the dysfunctional things. And we pay for it generationally with all of the kids who are learning and living in the same sort of poisonous harm that the kid was exposed to when they were abused. So, you know, it's time we start talking about it. We should reform statute of limitations. And my belief, and the reason why I took up this cause when the man walked into my office, is because I believed him. But over time, I realized, you know what, if we're going to effectuate change, let's hit them where it hurts most. And sadly, sometimes that is the pocketbook.
Just a quick comment on that. There's a great book by a man named Tim Litton, Lytton, called Holding Bishops Accountable. But it's not applicable just to the Catholic situation. He argues that tort law and civil litigation has actually moved the church, the Catholic Church, in a reform direction it would never have gone in without that kind of pressure. And I think he makes a good case for that.
So we have time for one more question.
I thank the panelists for being here, especially Elizabeth. I think each of us have a part. We like a product in America when we do not like or not satisfied with a product. We stop buying from that company or we stop buying that brand. And here I see people asking, like, when is this going to change? How's the Catholic, government going to take care of these issues or address these issues? And I am really saddened for these children. I don't go to the Catholic Church. I withdrew my membership because I don't want to condone those actions against helpless children. It makes me cry what these children went through. And so I just wish that people can, parishioners, when they go to their church, maybe a day or a morning where, you know, they show solidarity for these children. You know, we can work like that too. And this is to the community. Thank you.
I would like to say that I think Bill has to take off immediately afterwards, but I think the rest of us are going to be able to hang out in the lobby if any of you want to talk to us anymore. Ralph has a lot of information in terms of therapy resources, and we also tried to put some other resources out there in terms of healing and recovery, and also information about Voice of the Faithful, which is a Catholic reform group, which very Catholic, but also interested in making changes and very supportive of abuse survivors. So please look at the literature table and talk to us afterwards.
I want to thank Elizabeth Harden Barola for pulling this together again. Terry McKiernan, Robert Pastor, Ralph Lynn, and Bill Keeler. Let's give them a round of applause.
Hello, everybody. My name is Shirlene Rogers-Jeremiah, and I am the person that Elizabeth is talking about. I want to thank you, Elizabeth, for having this. I'm blessed to have met you. I'm thankful that you've given me the courage to tell my story in the newspaper, even though we were under an alias. I appreciate everything that you've done. I appreciate everything that you're doing now. And I appreciate everybody up there. And I also appreciate everyone coming here. One person can make a difference. As hard as it is. So we need to figure out ways on how to reach these kids and do something more for them so that way they can have the strength and the courage to speak up and say something. So I just want to say thank you.
Thank you, everyone, for coming, and thank you to the panel.